You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, welcome to the Innovation for Alpha podcast. I'm your host, Tobin Arthur, and I am joined today by Matan McGrill, who is just an incredible guy. We're going to have some fun in this discussion today, and I am really excited to introduce him to all of you. Matan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tobin. Excited to be speaking with you.
Well, it's hard to even know where to jump in because you and I have had a number of discussions. You have done so many fun things in your career, but maybe just give everybody a snapshot of how you started your career and some of the things that you've done over the years, and then we'll kind of move things to more to the present.
Sure. I'll give you the abridged version, because if I was to give you the entire story, we'll have a 2-hour podcast. I actually started off at HSBC in their rotational investment banking program. I think it was on my second day there that I realized that I was a lot of things, but an investment banker wasn't going to be one of them. It took me another 7 months to leave HSBC, and I was presented with an opportunity by a very dear friend of mine who was based out of Shanghai at the time. Mind you, this was the height of the recession. We're talking 2008. So I guess it was a smart decision to be leaving HSBC at the time. But my dear friend Travis Sheff was based out of Shanghai. He had the clever idea of starting a business in China when everything over, you know, in our side of the world was looking very grim. And his idea was to start the first large music event, Western music event in China. And he kept badgering me to come over and join him in Shanghai. And I took two suitcases and he met me in Pudong Airport. And we initially started trying to create Shanghai's first electronic music festival. Very quickly realized that wasn't going to happen. We were going to have to take baby steps. And that's what we did. We started with an artist booking agency, the name of Imperial Entertainment. We started bringing Western artists over to tier one cities in China. That business evolved into a full event production business. We were doing a lot of really large events all over Asia with a concentration on tier one, tier two cities in China. After 2 years, Travis left for law school in Boston. I didn't have enough of Shanghai quite yet. And I was a part of the founding team of Advocacy Asia, which was China's essentially first word of mouth marketing platform. We were bringing over FMCG, Western conglomerates to the Chinese market via a platform that we created, which was inducing organic word of mouth on behalf of Chinese consumers. I did that for about 3 years. That company was acquired, at which point I too had enough of my China adventure, and I moved back stateside. I relocated to New York. And it was then that I founded Foodie Trip. And Foodie Trip was a love at first sight for me. It was a business that I started because of my love for travel, and more specifically, my love of trying different culinary experiences abroad. And essentially did exactly that. It was a marketplace which connected local food guides with travelers all over the world in order for those travelers to eat like locals, instead of getting stuck in a McDonald's branch somewhere. We've raised a couple of institutional rounds for Foodie Trip. Company's still very much alive and well. It was during my time at Foodie Trip that I was surrounded by a whole bunch of very clever entrepreneurs, people who were introducing really innovative IP into their specific verticals, people who really knew what they were doing. You could call them subject matter experts within their individual fields. They were on top of their operations. The one common challenge that they're all facing is a lack of understanding of the capital raise process. They either didn't have access to capital. If they did, they didn't really know how to interact with investors and get their hands on that capital. And that was something that really bothered me. I was seeing too many solid businesses shut down their doors, not because the entrepreneurs at the helm were subpar in any way, but just because they didn't have access to put their businesses on a hyper-growth kind of trajectory. And that's when I started a passion project alongside Foodie Trip. which did exactly that, helping entrepreneurs initially within my own social circle to create a narrative that was an investor-facing narrative, to articulate that narrative into a wide variety of investor-facing collateral, whether it was pitch decks or financial performas, one-pagers, et cetera. Once we got the attention of investors via those pieces of collateral, we started helping them with deal structure. What investment vehicle were they going to raise in, valuation reports, et cetera. And then finally, I started doing kind of deal flow, right? I had a lot of exposure to VCs, both here in New York and the West Coast. And I started kind of putting the dots together. That was 5 years ago. That passion project has evolved into what is Jetpack today. It's a one-stop shop capital advisory for startups. We're a team of 10. We do everything in-house. We have our own kind of consultants, financial advisors, copywriters, designers, all of whom still very much take part in those three different buckets that I mentioned before, whether it's collateral, investor-facing collateral, deal structure, deal flow. And that's where I am today. I'm at the helm of Jetpack. I told you, I'll try to give you the abridged version.
No, that's cool. There's so much in there. You know, Foodie Trip is just such a neat business because I share the same interest in travel and food. It's almost like Anthony Bourdain meets local travel. Just before we get off that topic, how much have you been able to, you know, go out and travel the world and, you know, sort of work on building that? Has it given you a personal opportunity to kind of see the landscape?
In terms of Foodie Trip or in terms of Foodie Trip,
yeah, specifically.
Yeah. So let's start with the fact that I've been fortunate enough to live in 4 different countries and 15 different cities so far. Originally from Israel, I grew up in South Florida. I studied in Italy for a time. I spent some time in London, moved to Shanghai, like I mentioned before, Hong Kong. And I always found myself learning or getting some sort of insight into the local cultures by filling my belly and having a beer with the locals in that particular place. I found that was the easiest way to connect and get a true representation of that specific culture. And over the years, I've done culinary centric trips. In other words, trips that were meant only for me to be as gregarious and kind of eat my way through these cities. And I've gone on some adventures. You know, the very idea for Foodie Trip actually started when I was doing a motorcycle trip in Vietnam from Ho Chi Minh City all the way to Hanoi. Mm. And it was, it was 2 weeks worth of me, you know, kind of doing research beforehand and finding myself surrounded by other tourists in places that were supposed to be very, very local. And I very quickly got tired of it. I saw a small street sign that said nighttime motorcycle food tours. Those are all things that I like. I called the number on that street sign. And at 10 o'clock, a Vietnamese woman on a motorcycle showed up, told me to hop on the back of the bike. We were joined by 10 other travelers also on the back of bikes. And from 10 p.m. until 4 or 5 in the morning, they took us to some of the most authentic underground spots. I've got to drink snake wine. Wow. I was a happy camper. And that was kind of the light bulb moment for Foodie Trip. I said, this is how people need to start traveling. This is, and again, it wasn't just even the connection between us and the locals. It was also a connection between traveler and traveler. Oh. You know, we're all sitting around that table.
Sure.
And we're all, you know, had the same kind of philosophy, eat, drink, be merry. Let's go explore.
That's so cool. You have an uncanny ability to distill stories, tell stories, the capital raise side. Where'd that come from? Obviously you have natural talent, but was some of that from your HSBC, from your education? I mean, where did you pick these skills up over the years that have gone into Jetpack?
I think it's, so let me correct you. I don't think anybody's a natural storyteller. I think a lot of people would like to tell themselves that they're natural storytellers. I think that I've had loads of practice and a lot of trial and error to get to the point where I felt comfortable telling stories, especially investor facing stories. Wow, it's a challenge. And that's exactly that. I needed to raise rounds for my own companies, essentially in Asia and then for Foodie Trip here in the States. Mm-hmm. And I very quickly understood the amount of sweat, blood, and tears that is required in order to engage an investor. And I also very much understood that the ethos of a company is something that's very, very important in trying to convert investors. You know, you can have technical facts and you can have traction from here to Sunday. If you can't convey a very, very engaging story to an investor, they're not going to convert. They're human beings just like you and I. So trial and error. And I think, again, on a personal note, it is that the fact that I am an immigrant, I've moved around a lot, I've always needed to be a bit more animated, I've always needed to kind of be articulate in order to maybe fit in socially, maybe kind of get the spotlight on me that wasn't necessarily there to begin with. So I think it's a combination of the two.
That makes sense. You know, as you've learned over the years and as you've built Jetpack, maybe share a couple things that have emerged as patterns in terms of when you're working with startups, things that you see that typically they may do wrong, or where they're making mistakes, or whether they can improve. Are there things that have jumped out where you almost always say, here's two areas where you know everybody's going to need to improve? Or what comes to mind when you think about some of the patterns?
I think let's start actually with the macro side. So I think what we're seeing in the macro side is that a lot of entrepreneurs, especially first-time entrepreneurs, are seeing what's going on in the private market today and go into the capital raise process with the train of thought that this is going to be a 2-week thing, you know, between the time of them sending out, whether it's called emails or connections, meeting the investors in a pitch meeting and getting that wire transfer into their account. This, the capital raise process, especially the early rounds, difficult. It's a difficult and long process. It takes a lot of effort. I would say that it takes it becomes a full-time job for the executive team. It becomes a full-time job specifically for the CEO. And it takes anywhere between 4 to 6 months if everything is done correctly. So the very first thing is that we're seeing at Jetpack is a lot of entrepreneurs thinking, you know, let's get this done. Let's do this over a 3-week period. There needs to be a complete mental shift going into that process. It's a long process and the boxes need to be ticked off before any investor is going to write a check. In terms of the micro things, we'll start with the collateral side of things. I think that that entrepreneurs a lot of times are too deeply inside the trenches of the story. They tend to concentrate on very, very minor details of the IP. They tend to not necessarily provide a big kind of, hey, this is how the IP is going to be of value to my end user. It becomes a very technical kind of discussion. I'm not saying, but by no means am I saying that that needs to go, you know, there needs to be no technical or no, you know, deep dive into IP. But if the investor doesn't understand the big picture of how it is that your customer is going to benefit from your IP, the technicals don't matter. So that's one. The other thing that we're seeing is no call to action. We're seeing a lot of no call to actions being taking place, or a very weak call to actions. What is your ask? What are you going to be utilizing that ask for? How is it going to change the trajectory of the company from a revenue, user acquisition, IP development standpoint? Show us what you're going to be utilizing your funds for. Show us how much money you need. Tell us how you're going to be raising it, et cetera. There are so many times that we've experienced pitch decks that would have been solid or other pieces of collateral that would have been solid, but there's no hook. There's absolutely no, this is what I need to get out of this meeting by the end of this meeting. So I would say from a tactical perspective, those two are big no-nos that we're seeing repeat themselves with an investor-facing collateral.
That makes a lot of sense. And as you mentioned on the timelines, I think it does a disservice for a lot of entrepreneurs. They read various blogs and journals and they see all these successes. And what they take away from that a lot of times is that raising money is easy. It's happening everywhere. Even you hear things like there's so much capital in the market. And while that may be true in a macro sense, it still doesn't diminish the hard work that it takes. And as you said, the timelines. And I think that's discouraging, right? A lot of entrepreneurs get going in the process and they wonder, why am I not raising and this and that? When you think about and you've interacted with teams, do you find there's, and let's focus on the early stage, let's say a seed round, do you find there's a particular structure for the team in the sense of the CEO is on point and the rest of the team are playing certain roles? Or do you find it's more successful when there's somebody working for the company that's kind of the point person on capital development? And Amy, what have you seen that's worked? And I'm sure there's different, you know, variations on the theme, but how should the entrepreneur, the CEO, the founder be thinking about best structuring a process for their seed round?
Sure. So for the seed round specifically, the CEO is the point person for anything. There is nobody else that the investor is going to be expecting to communicate the value proposition, the story, the ROI rather, et cetera, except for the CEO. The CEO is the entire thing. You know what I mean? There's no alternative to it. And that's exactly why, by the way, that's one of the reasons why we also coach a lot of the CEOs that we work with post collateral creation in terms of the delivery and the communication, the messaging of the collateral we just created. How is it that we actually, you know, articulate all of that efficiently in front of investors? I highly recommend that there is no substitute for a CEO in the process.
That makes sense. And let's touch a little bit on your point about the ROI or the ask. So what I've seen a lot is that an entrepreneur has a great, let's call it just a widget. They've got some widget that's faster, better, cheaper. And so their pitch essentially is, I've got a faster, better widget. But that doesn't necessarily address the question of how does this become a business or a successful business? And as an investor, how do I get my money out of this business? What's the end game? How do you balance that? Like, how do you think about the fact that they need to focus on what they're building, but that also telling the investor story?
That's an excellent question. Vision is very much a part of the, even at early rounds, of the investor facing story. It has to be. And if we get into the tactics of it, every pitch deck does start, you know, with the widget, if you want to call it, right? How does it work? Why is it useful, et cetera? Every pitch deck that we create also ends with, how does this widget evolve into something that is completely scalable and is used by a much larger target demo to the target demo that the original widget actually focuses on, right? Who are your strategic partners to make that happen? What additional IP development do you need in order for that widget to become a platform, right? I'm using the same analogy here. What marketing channels are you going to have to utilize in the future? We don't usually talk about exit strategy this early on, but it should be something that the entrepreneur is comfortable speaking about, you know, off the record with investors. It needs to be a part of the vision. But like I said, it's a very, very fine balance of explain to me how the widget works today and how it becomes a very, very large scalable platform 2-3 years from now.
We are building a partnership, which I'm very excited about, between Jetpack and AngelMD, and we'll be revealing more about that in the coming weeks. But give us a sense of how you guys work. And one of the things that I love that you guys do is you really understand this space of distilling the stories and getting these into collateral and materials that are going to help the entrepreneur. It's really just filling up their toolbox. And for most entrepreneurs, and I would venture to say a very high percentage, this is not their skill set. Even if it was, it would take them 5 times longer than it's going to take you guys. But there's a lot of work involved. Walk through just a little bit of that process from when you first hear the story from the entrepreneur to how you guys end up with the collateral package that they need to start pitching.
Sure. So I think the very first step is understanding if the company actually needs to raise capital, right? That's the very first kind of evaluation that we provide. So we sit down, we hear the story, we understand what the status quo is for that particular company. And then we ask the very basic question, do you need money? And if so, how much money do you actually need? Okay. So those are the first initial questions we ask. And if the and it's an affirmative answer and a dollar amount that is significant enough to go for a round, that's when we start getting the ball rolling. We start off with an onboarding questionnaire that we provide to the companies we work with, which serves as a data dump for us to understand everything that they're sitting on, everything that's in their heads transferred to our heads, at which point we review that questionnaire. And my team and I start creating a narrative that we believe, based on our market research and an understanding of investors in that particular vertical, would resonate with investors. We back that narrative up with market research that we do internally, whether it's competitive landscape analysis, whether it's a market size analysis, et cetera, at which point we go back and we present a very ugly piece of collateral, right? Undesigned, but has all of the has a complete anchor, I would say, from a narrative content perspective to the entrepreneurs, explain what our thinking, what our logic behind that narrative is, take their notes on it, go back and integrate those notes into the narrative that we created, go back to them once again for another revision round in order to fine tune everything, at which point we go into design. That's the pitch deck process. At the same time, our financial analysts, once we've agreed on the narrative, begin to model out the five-year projections, and we create these really, really efficient, dynamic financial models, which are very much meant for stress testing on behalf of investors. But the most important thing is that those two pieces of collateral, the pitch deck and the financial projections, are completely uniform in the messaging that they provide to the investor. And basically from a collateral standpoint, that's the process. It's two back and forths and a lot of strategic thinking on our behalf on what it is that's going to convert with the very specific targeted investors within their verticals.
Love it. Talk just a little bit about your perspective, because you see a lot of things. You're in a really unique position. And so you're seeing some trends in the market. You know, what are you seeing right now that's particularly personally interesting in terms of investable companies, whether that's, you know, blockchain related, crypto, cannabis, whatever, you know, what are you seeing that you like and you're excited about?
So for what I'm excited about is going to bore your listeners to death. I've been excited about last mile logistics for a very, very long time. We've cracked a lot of logistics. We have yet to crack last mile logistics, whether it's food delivery, packages, et cetera. We're not there yet. We've been working with a lot of interesting companies in that space that are doing a lot of in-city mesh network delivery. That's their IP. Like I said, in different verticals, whether it's trying to break the monopoly that third-party food deliveries like Grubhub and Uber have in order to lower delivery times and lower delivery costs for the consumers and not necessarily hold the supply chain hostage like those third-party food deliveries do. That's my kind of nerdy, area of interest. We're seeing a lot of interest in cyber. Always, we're seeing a lot of interest in cyber. Obviously, ever since the pandemic, life science and health tech has been on the up and up. Interestingly enough, in that particular sector is where we find the most IP and the most difficulty telling the story of that IP on behalf of the entrepreneur, right? You can be a great, doctor, clinician, et cetera, not necessarily be a great storyteller. So we've seen a lot of companies in the health tech space recently. And again, I suspect that there's a direct correlation between the pandemic and the amount of money that's been going into that space, obviously. But we're seeing a lot of that on our doors, and that's something that investors can't get enough of right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. You actually could combine all three of those, because the pandemic also showcased the last mile supply chain problems in healthcare. And that can be everything from testing, you know, blood testing and various testing. And so it's getting slightly more efficient where people don't have to go to the big hospital to have their blood drawn. It's now somewhat available in strip malls and elsewhere. Although it's still extremely inefficient, probably 5 years from now, people are going to be saying they used to do what? And you could say the same thing about cyber. You know, there's a lot of, particularly cybersecurity, healthcare is a space where there's a lot of vulnerabilities. We're seeing, you know, obviously, if you crack into certain systems, you've got access to people's health information. Hospitals are very vulnerable. You've got IoT everywhere in healthcare. And so sensor vulnerability, it's going to be a big story in healthcare over the next several years. And we have some companies in our network. So it's interesting that you mentioned those, because I think healthcare, one of the fun things of healthcare is it tends to be behind some of these other industries in its adoption. The good news is, as some of these things get built out and proven in other markets, healthcare ultimately needs all of it, whether it's 3D printing, you talk about supercomputing, last mile infrastructure, cybersecurity, blockchain. Healthcare has it all, and it all ultimately has an impact. Matan, we're going to have some fun in the coming months talking more about Jetpack and exposing the capabilities of your team to the benefit of the thousands of companies in our network, because we have some great companies in the AngelMD network. But a company that can't tell and you know, document its story is going to be a company that is stalled. And so I'm really anxious to expose them to your team and resources. I think it's going to be a great help. And I really appreciate you jumping on today to just give a little snapshot of what's to come and the talent behind the scenes. So thank you.
Thank you, Tobin. And we look forward to working with the AngelMD family.
Well, it'll be fun. In the meantime, have a great Thanksgiving, Matan, and a great holiday season, and more to come over the next few weeks and months.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by AngelMD Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.